Lecture 34, I guess it is now, and it's objects, other representations, other not meaning of lesser importance, because we're going to be talking about, I think, the most important material representation, and it's hair. I say sacred, most sacred, particularly if you don't have any, but seriously, in folk practices, hair is of utmost importance. The animistic belief is that it says that parts of the body, including the placenta and hair, notably right now looking at hair mainly, but teeth, saliva, sweat, tears are sort of the soul stuff. Tears definitely more part of some than others, but hair couldn't be of any more importance in Islam. And the traditions say that the prophets, that's the Arabian prophet, Muhammad's spittle, his urine, his blood, and his hair were, of great value. And there is a lot of spitting and blowing, and then specifically we're going to look at some of the fact that hair is the way through which bewitching is done, hair cuttings, and particularly when you get your hair cut. In Morocco, women hang their hair, in other words, they cut the hair. When they get their hair cut, they hang it on a tree of the saint. In other words, where the shrine is, there's always, remember, there's a tree there. And sometimes they say that here the saint planted his staff and up came the tree. But there they would hang their hair on the branches of the tree, hoping to gain some help and blessing, and also perhaps even a miracle. In Saudi Arabia, Egypt, North Africa, hair clippings and nails are disposed of very carefully. In North Africa, a man won't let his hair be cut in the presence of an enemy. Why? Because the enemy could use that against him to put a curse on him and to cause him harm. In Bahrain, your fingernails are discarded in a piece of white cloth with a magic formula. So back to Muhammad. When Muhammad shaved, even in his day, in other words, not even to mention today, 1,500 years later, even in his day, it had already gotten to the place where every hair was kept for good omen, for blessing, and preserved as relics among Muslims. When I say preserved, we're going to note that more hairs have been preserved than ever existed a million times over. Because they're always claiming that here is a relic that is one of Muhammad's hairs. So we're really talking about hairs of the Prophet, not heirs of the Prophet, are of most importance. Before we start talking about Tunis, let me tell you a little bit of a story about Afghanistan. Not sure where it is, but I think it was Mazar-e-Sharif, which is way up north if you look on the map, but I'm not exactly sure. But in any event, J. Christie Wilson talks about this in, I believe, his book on prayer, praying for Muslim converts. He says that in this town, there was talk of building a school for boys. Good idea, said everybody. Great idea, let's build it. But then somebody came back from the pilgrimage with a hair in his hand. He said, this is a hair of Muhammad, and what we need to do is we need to take that money that was set aside for a school for the boys and build a shrine for the hair of Muhammad. Well, you know, who can disagree with that? After all, this would bring good luck and all this kind of stuff. But a journalist in the town said, wait a minute, if Muhammad was here, you know, Muhammad would want education of the boys, more than that, that we spend this money on a shrine for Muhammad. Well, the journalist who spoke up and said this was basically run out of town. And that's the only way, I guess, the government saved his neck was by giving him a job outside of the town because he had dared to object. Well, talking specifically now about Tunis, in Tunis, nail parings are buried or burnt. In Algeria, if nail trimmings fall on the ground, Satan can use them, and he does use them. In Iran, nail trimmings are sometimes kept in bottles till the resurrection. In Java, Indonesia, you can't cut your nails on Friday or after dark. And the Malays think that a guy is in danger if his hair or nails are cut. So often, what do? Get them cut by a friend. And after ihram, you know, ihram is the state of purity when you're on the pilgrimage. So when you go this, you know, ihram is also the gown or the clothes that they wear, but ihram is that state. So after that, then you are not to get your hair cut or your nails cut or anything like that. Zwemer talks about that, but it's well known. I mean, it's well known in his book, The Influence of Animism on Islam, page 66, and so forth or onward. Fingernails in Uzbekistan are the way to put a curse on somebody, and I have had former students in my class and have talked to them who've come back from Central Asia and have confirmed this and talked about it in class and in private conversation. A placenta often is buried by the midwife in the cemetery to avoid attack by jinn. You see, the baby is pretty vulnerable. Small babies, and then of course the mother is too when she's expecting and pregnant and stuff, but then the baby is the mother continues to be vulnerable, so that's one thing that often is done. Dirt, excretions, and things like that too are to be noted as sacred objects. And images. Wanted to just say something about images. You know, I don't know about this. This is just some wild thinking, perhaps. But you do know that Muslims are totally against showing any images of the Prophet or any Prophet. This is really something that they don't want to do. And also, you know, you don't show images or take pictures of people with the camera. That's dangerous because the idea is, I think, besides the modesty and besides the other issues that Muslims talk about, is that if you get someone's image, then you have some control over them. I mean, this is an old idea in animism. And I have wondered if their strong objection to images of the Prophet have anything to do with their animism, their idea that, you know, and if also, of course, if you get a picture of a woman and you can perhaps possess her or force her to marry you and stuff like that. So images, I believe that their aversion to images, I wonder, really, I'm just sort of thinking off the top of my head here, has anything to do with this concept. Now, masks are another thing. If you get a person's mask, then you can use that to put a curse against someone. The eye too, you know, is very, very important, and we've talked about the evil eye. I'm going to, if God wills, show you some before this course is over, some of the stuff that I have gathered and that friends, students, particular former students have sent me from here and there, Turkey and wherever, of, you know, the objects that Muslims use, like a Starbucks cup and so on, in Turkey. Now, Fatima's hand, this is what this represents. I don't know. Keep your eyes open for this kind of stuff, because Fatima's hand. And notice the five fingers here. This represents the hand of Fatima. And why is it used? It's a protection against the curse. Five fingers. Of course, other things too, in other words, are represented here. But, you know, the five pillars of Islam, it's a protective gesture. And as I've mentioned before, when you're preaching, you don't want to go doing this here because you would be, could be interpreted as warding off a curse. So you have to change your preaching style when you're in the Muslim world if you are prone to those kind of gestures. There are two amulets here in this. This is the first one here on top. It's got all kinds of stuff. These are not earplugs. But this was found on the left arm of a Turkish officer during a fight with the Arabs at the Suez Canal. Now, the Suez Canal is this amazing canal that was built joining the Mediterranean Sea with the Red Sea. That's an amazing work of man, really, and women, I suppose we could say, of human beings. The second amulet here in the bottom was found on Shatt al-Arab, where the Tigris and the Euphrates merge. So I guess we would be down here. The Tigris and the Euphrates River merge right here, and that's where this other was found on the body of somebody else, an officer. So you see, they would wear these amulets hoping to save, be delivered and protected from harm and danger. Now, also other representations are animal representations. For example, the antlers of a deer in Afghanistan ward off the evil eye. I have friends who do a lot of hunting, and this one particular fellow has more antlers in his living room than you can shake a stick at. I think his wife finally got to his wife. You see, this is to a Muslim, this would be something else. Antlers of a deer in Afghanistan ward off the evil eye. And the fish symbol is for protection as well. I wonder where that comes from, don't you? Because the fish in Christianity too is a symbol of Christianity. You see the cars, and you know, Christian, they got this fish on the back. I've never put one on mine, but I'm not, because I'm not much for that kind of stuff. But the fish is a symbol of for protection in Islam, and Musk talks about that in his book, page 69. Here are a few fishies down here. Then there's vegetation and material representations. Sufis in Turkey consider the tree sacred. At least I suppose the extreme ones would because many Muslims would think that's really idolatrous. But they would, according to some, maybe a phallic symbol from the fertility cult. I won't say anything about that because I don't really know, but there is a lot of those symbols. There has been since the beginning of time, worshipped. In other words, those kind of symbols. Now, what about manufactured material? Well, beads. I did bring one thing today, and that is the beads. I'll hold them up here. Hope you can see them. These are the prayer beads called tasbih in Pakistan. Have other names in other places. You know, an Orthodox Muslim would denounce these. He would say, this is not right. This is not. But beads are used very, very much. Now, blue for children and for vulnerable animals. Now, what do they mean by a vulnerable animal? Would it be a tiny, tiny little puppy or something very weak and small and delicate? Not necessarily. A water buffalo would be vulnerable because of its value. In other words, it gives milk, and if someone put a curse on that water buffalo and the milk dries up, wow. I mean, that's vulnerable. And so oftentimes they keep these animals in their courtyard lest someone put a curse on them. In Mori Rabat, Afghanistan, it talks about these kind of beads. I'm not sure what kind of beads those are, whether they're wind beads. I used to think wind beads. I really looked on the net for them and wasn't sure. It looks to me like it's beads that wind up, but I'm not sure because that's a kind of a word that you never know. But tied on the area of pain with the hopes that it will alleviate the suffering. Now, continuing on with beads, we have, of course, in the history of Christianity, the rosary. Hail Mary, Christian used this beginning in the 11th century and could have been imported to Islam, according to Samuel Zwemer, who had all kinds of ideas about these kind of things, 200-300 years later, excuse me. In Algeria, there is divining done where the sick will die. How? It's used, they use the prayer beads. And you can see here prayer beads. I don't know why they would put this little thing here but those are used for divining, you know. The prayer beads are not just for prayer, you know, remembering the name of God. They're used for devotion, and they're used for divining too, to figure out, you know, who put the curse on you, or so on and on. In Java, well, back to Tunisia, it's similar to Algeria and Iran. That's how you figure out what kind of medicine, In Java, this is used for healing, for sick, and you hold it in your hand and read to the 15th verse of some kind of a reading, presumably a Quranic reading, and you have a talismanic power. During the reading, you count on the rosary, you see, just bicking a bead at random and working your back way back to the pointer. Now, in Egypt, the Copts too, I don't want to pick on the Copts because I know that there are Copts who don't believe in this stuff, but they would sometimes use means like this to cure, retention of urine, people who have weak kidneys or something like that. Again, Zwemer gives witness to this kind of stuff. Now, there is note here of bells. Generally, Muslims don't like bells. You know, we play the bells, don't we, on our churches. I go to Germany every year, sometimes more, and I am very much impressed by the church bells as I get up, you know, Sunday morning and I hear the church bells. Muslims say sometimes, and you can Google this and look at it yourself, maybe study it, they say that the bells attract the devil, just like whistling attracts the devil. You know, you wonder really why they, where they get these ideas, but sometimes you never know really what Muslims are thinking. Containers, I'm not going to say anything about those because I don't know what to say, bracelets and anklets, these are all manufactured material that could be used in some way, shape, or form for folk practices. Bowls, yes, definitely bowls are sacred, can be sacred as well. And of course, the Quran and Quranic materials. These are all considered to be sacred stuff. Depending on the area, used in different ways. Names. And then we've, you know, numbers. Magic numbers. We've talked about this, the fact that that numbers have great value. You know, I can remember hearing about this kind of stuff in Christian circles too. I can remember a guy, and there have been many times people have spoken on numbers in the Bible. You know, 7 is the perfect number, and 3, and all this, and 40. Well, Muslims have this too, and they give great value to numbers. 7, I think, is a perfect number. But God, does he like odd numbers? It would seem that there's something like that. Because Muslims have the idea that, you know, when you throw stones at the devil on the Hajj, you have to throw an odd number of numbers. I think 49, but they couldn't agree. I heard some discussion there. They weren't exactly sure how many. And when you cleanse yourself, you have an odd number of numbers and so on. It's quite interesting, is it not? Numbers. And then, of course, artifacts and relics. We've talked about those a lot. Relics of the Prophet, relics of the saints. We're more to come on that. Here's a little bit of discussion. A good friend, this is a religious guy, somebody's telling this story. It didn't happen to me, but this religious guy in his 20s with whom you have been spending time. Spending time talking about the Lord, about Christianity. He doesn't seem to have much interest at all. But then, one day, he says his parents find a little bag of food, spices, and other things in the cabinets. And what they're afraid of is that someone has put a curse on them. And so he wants to bring in the sheikh to cleanse the house. And he asks you, what should you do? What would you do? Here again, as we've talked about before, and if we were face-to-face in a classroom, would have you, break up into small groups and talk about this. You'd want to set this up in a careful, thoughtful way and say something like this to them. Yes, I will cleanse the house, but I won't do it in conjunction with the sheikh, because I know that Jesus can cleanse the house, and if you're going to call on me, then I will do it. If you're calling the sheikh, you can do it. But don't call on both of us, because I want Jesus to have the glory. I mean, maybe this sounds a little bit dogmatic, but you do want to you want people to understand where the power is coming from. You don't want to, because sometimes they'll go to this person, that person, that person, then, something will work. You don't want to set it up that way. Jesus will never get any glory that way. You want to set it up so that when all else fails, then Jesus is going to come in and cleanse the place if, in fact, there is a curse put on it. This is a difficult situation, isn't it? But you want to glorify God. You want to set it up so that he gets the glory through Christ.